Hello and welcome to the Freight Find Podcast, your source for all things freight transportation. I'm Chris Kaplis, Chief Scientist at DAT Freight and Analytics, and today I'm joined by Derek Gittos, Vice President, Supply Chain Management Product Strategy at Oracle. Derek's been in the software space, mainly in freight transportation and supply chain, for over 25 years. He first started at Transport Dynamics, a pioneering software firm founded by Warren Powell out of Princeton, and now for the last 20 years, he's been at Oracle. He brings a ton of experience with him, not only in the design and development of supply chain management software, but also in how shippers, carriers, and brokers are using these tools and how that's evolving. We discuss how the market and industry is changing and where it might be heading in the future. So following my conversation with Derek, I'll be joined by Dr. Ian Amayu to discuss the truckload market update. So let's get started. Welcome to the Freight Find Podcast, Derek.
Thank you, Chris. I'm super excited to be here today.
All right. So it's funny. I've known you, Derek, for 20 years, but we just met face-to-face, I think, about 2 weeks ago. So it's one of those where I can't blame it on the pandemic. Actually, the pandemic maybe brought us together to the same conference. So you've been in it for 20 years. So what have you seen that's changed? What's the biggest change that you've seen over the 20 plus years you've been in the software space?
Yeah, well, I think as I reflect on that, one of the biggest changes that kind of immediately comes to mind is this breaking down of barriers within organizations and between companies and supply chain networks. You know, so internally, you know, breaking down barriers between the different departments and functions, transportation, warehousing, customer service, logistics, and externally, between the different parties, carriers, shippers, suppliers. Right. So I think overall, we're in a much better state as far as being able to drive improved performance because of better information sharing and all that. I mean, still not perfect by any means, but if you wind the clock back 20, 30 years ago, we're in a far better place today.
But do you think, I'm just curious, which are the worst barriers, the ones that are the hardest to break down, the internal or the external between companies?
I would have to give the slight nod to the external, simply because there's, you know, trust issues and corporate policy issues. And, you know, the lawyers worry about other companies more than they do people inside the fence. Yeah. But both I think have really been a challenge, more than the technology. Definitely more people driven there.
Yeah. What I found for some companies is that if you have a contractual relationship with someone, it defines the rules of the road. But sometimes there isn't a formal tit-for-tat relationship between, say, the warehousing team versus the transportation. And so it's kind of soft and fuzzy. Have you seen that get harder or easier to manage?
I think overall easier to manage, but it's still difficult. And a lot of it stems from how those departments are measured. I mean, we all respond to how we're measured and incentivized. So if you have a set of KPIs that you're measured against and those are, you know, run contrary to KPIs that your colleagues are being measured against, then you're going to generate that kind of tension. But I think, you know, more organizations have sort of understood that those tensions need to be addressed and we can't sub-optimize in one area at the expense of another.
Right. So the SCORE model from the late 90s, early 2000, looking at across the whole supply chain. But the challenge for those that I've seen is that as they get more integrative, you know, across the whole supply chain, they lose their direct applicability to me, to my decision and my function. Have you seen that same tension? If so, how do you see companies managing that?
That's a great point. You know, it's kind of this difference between, I want to say user optimal and system optimal.
Oh, you're talking like an OR guy now.
You must have gone to Princeton. I had to dig deep into my repertoire to pull that out. But but yeah, it's not easy for people to understand that I may have to sub-optimize my performance in order for the system, the supply chain, to perform at peak. You know, that requires an education, if you will, that requires management support, because ultimately somebody, the CEO, the board of directors, you know, they're responsible for the performance of a whole, not the performance of any individual. And it won't matter if some individual did really well and the company did poorly. So I think organizations have begun to understand that more and understand how these different metrics and behaviors, you know, play into one another.
Yeah. And it goes beyond, like you said, software and the platform. It's really, how do you compensate the division or the function that is increasing its cost? Because typically it's the rare transformation I've seen where everyone's costs go down. Someone usually goes up a little, right? And then the whole line share, the whole company as a whole goes down. Have you given any thought to how that compensation works or that trade-off works? Is that something you've seen is standardized, or is it still pretty ad hoc and different customer to customer?
Yeah, I think one of the things you need to do is sort of move away from what I'll call these kind of, you know, location-based performance metrics, like the profitability of my warehouse versus your warehouse sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at it from, you know, is the profitability our cost to serve for this customer or this right. market segment or these product categories? Because it might be, you know, we're running out of product in this location. And in order to meet the demand in that region, we're going to ship product from somebody else's warehouse. It's more expensive because maybe it's farther away. But that doesn't mean we should ding the profitability of that warehouse that we pulled that product from because they had to ship something across the country that they wouldn't, you know, normally have done.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the whole idea of a cost to serve allows you not just to allocate the cost, but to see, are you over-serving or under-serving some of your customers to find out what it really costs to serve that customer. And I've seen some companies where they do segmentation and they don't fire a customer, but it changes their approach.
We slow walk them out the door.
Something like that. So back to big changes over 20 years. So breaking down of barriers, that makes a ton of sense. Do you think the biggest driver of that was improvements in technology, data availability? We're swimming in it now. Management acceptance of things. What else? What do you think caused this breakdown of barriers the most?
Well, I think clearly technology has played a huge role in enabling the changes and improvements that have happened. I mean, it's certainly difficult to imagine going back to the days back before internet-based communications and smartphones and cloud computing and sort of things always being on. But at the end of the day, those are all just tools, and it takes people to put those tools to work and actually make change happen. And I think the real credit goes to, you know, the people in the industry, the organizations in the industry that were willing to do something different and do something that was unproven and take the risk and sort of change the status quo for the benefit for all those who followed later.
Yeah, because it's funny. I agree with you. It's not just the technology, because sometimes this technology comes and it takes decades for it to be adopted. I was working on ASPs, application service providers, that became SaaS, that is now cloud, right? Where it was, you don't host the server, it's hosted somewhere else. In this case, it was part of Sabre, I think, at that point. But it didn't really take on. It was a dirty word to have ASP, as opposed to now. Do you have many implementations that are actually server in the company's basement?
Yeah, I mean, since over the last 5 years, 6 years, no. that market has completely shifted. No one would think about, no, I'm going to buy a bunch of, first of all, if you could buy it today, buy hardware and then, you know, set it up and build a disaster recovery capability somewhere else. And gosh, that's a very complicated way of doing business.
Much less staff it, find that yes. for it. Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Focusing on TMS side of the whole supply chain software, which you've been working in since, you know, you were with Transport Dynamics back in the 90s. Do you think TMS development has improved faster or slower than other supply chain functions?
I would put it in the upper quartile. You know, again, indicated there, I've been working around transportation related technology for almost 30 years, so probably hard for me to answer that in a completely unbiased way. But I think given the complexity of the kind of transportation operations, that it has been a ripe area for early use of technologies that have right. sort of become mainstream later. So you talked about, you know, ASP and cloud.
Right.
We were doing ASP stuff over 20 years ago.
Right.
That, you know, and transportation out of all the supply chain applications was the first one where cloud really took off, as opposed to, let's say, warehouse management, which is another area my team looks after. They've been at the laggard end of adoption because everyone was like, well, I need to see the server in my warehouse, when really that's not the case. Or if we think about the use of optimization technologies, you know, linear integer programming, network optimization, you know, those are technologies that put to use, you know, in the 1980s. And now we're seeing use of, you know, artificial intelligence, machine learning based models for, you know, things like ETA, expected arrival time predictions, mm-hmm. and digital assistants for, you know, doing, you know, natural language inquiries on where's my shipment and so on, that I don't, certainly in our product portfolio, the transportation system has often been the leading user of those technologies.
One of the challenges that TMSs have, and most other systems as well, is the trade-off between standardizing and being able to customize. And I know the early G-Log stuff you were involved with, you know, 15, 20 years ago, really had a lot of customization for that. But sometimes you run the risk if you allow too much flexibility, it makes it too complicated for the user. How are you managing that trade-off between standardizing processes and being able to customize? Have you found a happy medium?
I think it's a medium we still try to improve upon, but we have definitely made strides. When we launched our cloud effort and offering, we did that in late 2014, early 2015, we had our first customers. We also had worked with Oracle Consulting very closely and a lot of our implementation partners and said, look, the expectation of this market, customers want to implement in 8 weeks, 12 weeks, nothing beyond, you know, kind of 3 months. So we need to do a lot of work in the pre-configuration of capabilities and really come to customers with, here's our predefined menu to choose from. And you got, you know, 6 or 7 things to choose from, not 100. And so that's definitely helped. And we've seen, you know, implementation times be, again, not in that 6 month, 9 month minimum, but rather in, you know, 2 to 3 months.
Wow.
Again, you may evolve and iterate from there, but it's not like you're waiting a year to see some kind of benefits begin to accrue.
Which was the way across the industry in the late 90s. You start because it seemed like everyone was a custom one. You go through the whole waterfall method. So it seems like that's really improved, not just it being in the cloud, but also that the processes are being a little more streamlined. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I'll go back to it's a people thing more than the technology. I mean, you could have achieved this with non-cloud technology, but cloud, I think, also sort of set an expectation. You know, we use it out of the box. You know, we use our Google email or, you know, whatever other sort of consumer cloud applications. And I would say people are more accustomed to, okay, we're going to use based what the options I can select from, as opposed to, well, I'm going to sit with a blank sheet of paper and dream up every function I've thought about for my last, you know, 15 years in this business.
Yeah, boy, you brought back a really evil memory of mine. I remember in the late 90s, letting people come up with their own custom reports, and we'd sit down and they'd come up with 40. Because if you ask someone to be creative and come up with something, they do. And then at the end of the day, 4 of them get used. So do you remember those days? Oh my gosh.
Yes. Yes.
And now that they can do that on their own. But another aspect of TMSs that had that standardization versus customization or dynamic nature is the routing guide, which is the classic function of a TMS, is that you have the routing guide established from a bid or some process, a load drops, and it's matched to the static routing guide that's usually set up once a year and maybe updated periodically. How have you seen that evolve, or has it evolved for your TMS over the last several years?
It's definitely evolved. I mean, there are still, I would say, organizations who do what you describe, which is, you know, I've got my rank one carrier, my rank two, you know, the first loser, second loser kind of thing, which is a kind of a strange model. But anyway,
we don't actually call them that though, Derek, right? We don't say you're the first loser.
No. That's, you know, gold medalist, silver medalist, you know, that type of thing. But I definitely see, certainly within our customers, a lot more of a dynamic approach. So yes, they've gone through a sourcing exercise. They have their preferred carriers. They have their contract rates. But then there's a lot of other factors of, you know, okay, so what am I consolidating today? Where is this, you know, for example, multi-stop route actually going to take me? What kind of commitments did I make to those carriers? So in other words, do I have to use somebody who's slightly more expensive maybe on this lane, but it allows me to meet my overall commitment, and incorporating capacity. What if I can only get 3 trucks a day from that one fellow? Then what 3 loads would I give them? Maybe not just the first 3 that appear during the day. So certainly TMSs have evolved to incorporate those factors. And I think organizations have also evolved to kind of let the system optimize across multiple factors to account for those changing conditions and an overall better kind of transportation reliability.
That's a really good point, because I think back when all the sophistication was in the bidding tool, right? And you come up with this, you'd have people have a scalpel and come up with this perfect design down to the, you know, carry, which loads carriers get strategically, that typically used to fall apart when it was fed into the, you know, wood chipper that is the traditional routing guide. And so maybe it's more that sophistication is now enabled in the operational stage. And that's why we can be more dynamic. We don't have to rely on that strategic plan to be perfect.
Certainly, if I think about key features we've added over the last well, not several years, but so for example, being able to account for that carrier capacity availability, you know, by day, yeah, by lane, by type of equipment, and the commitments of, okay, so when we negotiated that great rate and we said you were the preferred carrier, what was our commitment to you in terms of shipments per week or pounds per day or whatever, you know, whatever the metrics are, so that the wood chipper is a little more fine-tuned.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I wasn't referring to your routing guide as a wood chipper. That's just in general, that the routing guide just kind of, it's a matching tool to inbound to out, but they have gotten a lot more sophisticated.
Oh yeah, it's just a huge oversimplification basically, right? Because people can't deal with the complexity. So unless you have a TMS that can actually account for that, then you have to find another way to work the complexity out, and a routing guide will do that for you.
Another thing that's changed dramatically since the, I'd say, late 90s, early 2000s, is the way that shippers work with brokers. It used to be brokers were the providers of last resort, right? They were there for when all else failed, and now we're seeing them used more strategically within the TMS. And so what do you think? Well, first, have you seen that same, have you observed that same trend? And if so, what do you think caused it to happen?
You know, I think as you're again sort of indicated there, broker was a dirty word. It's like, yeah, no one wants to admit that they were calling a broker. And I think what's happened is really two things. One, the overall goal is you want reliable supply chain performance, and that requires reliable transportation capacity. And brokers are very well suited to addressing some of that variability that you can't account for when you did your big, you know, sourcing event. So low volume lanes, some short-term surges in demand. That's where the brokers, as sort of wholesale providers, aggregators of capacity, you know, play their part. And then the other thing that I think has really driven it, particularly the last couple of years, is the digital brokers, the new players, which have sort of changed the expectation of what it means to interact with the broker. So, you know, it's not phone calls and hopefully someone will get back to me a few hours later. Now you can get within your TMS, you know, visibility to real-time pricing and real-time visibility of capacity, and you can execute the loads with a click. It just sort of reduces all that friction and makes it a lot easier for the shipper to utilize that capacity just as they would any other form of capacity that they're managing.
So do you think that there's a stark difference between the quote digital brokers and traditional, or do you think it's more of a continuum?
I think it started off as sort of stark, you know, opposite ends of the spectrum, but I think it has blurred by virtue of the fact that the, what I'll call the traditional brokers, many of them have begun or have digitized their operations because that's now what the market, the shippers, being the market, that's what they expect. You know, they don't want to have to go to your website. They don't want to have to call your customer service department. They want to be able to see your rates and service level history and so on within their TMS, ideally within their TMS. And that should be, you know, a real-time API-based integration, not again, phone and email. So I think the traditional brokers have responded to that, many of them, and we work with both. And so I think that is really blurred to the point where there'll be digital brokers and then those that used to be in business.
So they're kind of absorbing, just kind of, because I think about how Uber and Lyft changed my taxi experience. I use Uber quite frequently. But when I used it before Uber, a taxi was just my gosh, the credit card machine wouldn't work. It'd be dirty. Post Uber and Lyft,
yes,
everything's risen. The expectations, like you said, really increased. And I think the same thing might be happening here.
Yeah, I believe so too.
So do you think there's a way, because this is something one of my doctoral students is looking into and trying to figure out, how do you measure how digital a broker is? And so do you think it's something we could look at like an efficiency play where we look at the number of load transactions handled by person by day? And then for digital, we assume that'll be a higher number. Do you think that's a metric that would make sense? Or is there another type of metric to classify these digital versus traditional brokers?
Yeah, that's a great question. I hadn't thought about that. You know, maybe one simple metric is, you know, can you go end to end in from a transaction perspective without ever having to talk or email anybody? So from the point you inquire, you know, hey, I have a load on this lane, you know, can you take it? What's the price? If you decide to take it, How are you going to confirm that with me and let me know when it was picked up and en route and delivered and invoiced? And if you can do all that without anyone ever having to pick up the phone or email somebody, then you've digitized it. Now, of course, maybe they've digitized it, but it's like a whole bunch of people running around behind the scenes feeding data into the machine. So to measure the true, that's sort of the digitization from the customer's point of view, their experience. But yeah, you would have to look at, you know, transactions per person, you know, how many loads are you handling? How many people are working in your operation center to actually make that happen?
What you described is kind of like faux digital, right? It looks digital, but there's a bunch of gerbils behind the scene running things around and calling.
Yeah. I think we used to call that sneaker net, you know, people.
Sneaker net. That's exactly right. But yeah, so maybe the number of transactions that are, you know, bloodless. One broker told me they want to be a bloodless broker, which no humans are involved in the transactions, which seemed a little, you know, cold-blooded, but still, I understand the sentiment. So maybe the number of transactions that didn't require a human voice or a human interaction, maybe that's a way to, I don't know how I'd get that data, but that might be the right metric.
Yeah, so it's a little harsh, but that humans are expensive and difficult to come by. And, you know, we want to be focused on higher function things. And I think a lot of those tasks are not, you know, don't fall into that category. So.
Yeah. In fact, I'm talking to one company, actually he's a former guest on the Freightfind podcast, Steve Judge from Newell. And what they did is that they went through, instead of bidding every lane out, because that used to be the method, right? If I had one load go over the course of a year on a lane, I put it out to bid next year just to see what the contract rate is. And instead they threshold, I want to say it was 12 loads per year. It might've been a little higher. They didn't even bid them out. They never entered the routing guide. Instead, they went straight to dynamic, straight to a API to a carrier, and they did some kind of very quick auto tender. And the justification was that why do you want someone spending time negotiating a contract rate in a lane that happens once a quarter, and instead focus them on other things? And maybe you pay a little more on these onesie twosie loads, but you're not wasting time, management time spent elsewhere. Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
Do you see any of your customers doing something like taking that approach where dynamic fits in? It's not just the mistakes anymore. It fits in to the strategy, overall strategy of a network.
Absolutely. I would say, now, not that every customer has this, but there's basically sort of three pools of capacity that customers are looking to manage. Either if they have a private dedicated fleet capacity, in some cases, their contracted capacity, and then their dynamic capacity.
Yeah.
As I said, it's not a dirty word. It's the way you handle that type of demand, the surges, the low volume lanes, because that's the most effective way to deal with it. It's not that you made a mistake that you had to call the broker. It's because that's the best thing to do. And you've planned for it.
Right, right. And that makes budgeting a little more, well, still probabilistic, but you get a better handle on it. And then the middle ground, that contracting, there's a lot of interest anyway to see if there's a better way to contract, because we both know where it's binding in price for the contract, but not in the capacity provided by the carrier or the volume provided by the shipper. That covers a lot of sins. And that just builds in almost hedging on both sides of that contract. So I'm wondering, have you seen any other types or forms of contracts finding their way into shipper carrier relations? Things like take or pay, index-based rates, guaranteed volumes, anything like that? Have you seen those coming into the system?
We've definitely seen the guaranteed volume, kind of this notion of a commitment that I mentioned, you know, before, like we will pay you. Pretty much we're guaranteeing that you're going to get the freight. I think, however, this is an area that's still ripe for innovation, because certainly by far, far and away, people are doing, call it the traditional model of, yeah, we're going to do all that contract negotiation, and then at the end of the day, it may not actually come to fruition when there's, you know, freight to be shipped and trucks that are needed to show up.
But to be fair, it usually happens, except for in extreme conditions, 80%+ of the time the contracts work, but it's those 20-15% of the time that cause the most problem and cause the most anxiety and costs.
That's very true.
Let's talk about the pandemic. How did the pandemic affect Oracle for your internal operations, your development, support, or anything else internal to your company? What was the biggest impact?
Overall, I would say in some respects, very little impact. Beyond, again, for some of us who were office-based, like me, I pretty much went into the office every day unless I was, you know, traveling somewhere. We already had a fairly significant number of people who are already working from home, like many of the people in my team, for example. Plus, we're a very global distributed company with people literally in locations all around the world. So being able to work through, whether it's in terms of, you know, developing new software features or running the cloud operations or taking customer, you know, support requests, we already had to really hone that model before the pandemic as far as being able to do that in a distributed fashion. What I would say where there was the biggest impact, however, is obviously, you know, we had to stop those in-person events, the, you know, our customer user group meetings and obviously some of the sales and marketing, which is typically a very high touch in-person kind of thing. That clearly was turned upside down. But as far as, you know, the day-to-day of writing new software and coding new features and getting them out to customers and supporting them, that really went on without a blink.
What about for your customers? Did you see any change in the behavior of your customers during the pandemic with respect to your systems, with your software systems?
That is a really good question too. So one of the things we felt, for example, like I think many companies at the beginning, we weren't really sure what was going to happen to our demand or to projects, you know, people who were planning an implementation or had just started. And although there was clearly some uncertainty in like those very first few weeks as everyone was really trying to figure out what was going to be happening, you know, overall, our demand continued to be very strong as far as new customers. In fact, if anything, I think the pandemic helped spur people who might have been on the fence because they're like, you know, we really need, you know, technology to help us here. And the implementations continued. So people, you know, found a way to do the work. And I think one of the lessons learned talking to some of our partners is that, you know, you really don't need to have consultants on site all the time to do this work. It can be done, you know, remotely or in some, you know, kind of hybrid fashion. So I think we'll see just a general, it won't be as fast of the return to all the travel and things that we did before, because a lot of it we found to be not really all that valuable.
But how are they going to get all their frequent flyer miles and their status on airlines, Derek? You're not thinking it through.
Yes, yes. Well, I know United is wondering where I've been.
So the kind of tying into that, are there any silver linings? It sounds like this might be a silver lining that the pandemic kind of forced, that you can do some hybrid implementations. You don't need to be face-to-face. Any other kind of silver linings, practices you had to use during the pandemic that you think will stay along?
Yeah, I mean, I think for one thing, we've become even better at doing remote virtual work, whether that's individually or, you know, as in like individually working from home without people, you know, around us, you know, better home office setups, better, you know, software, better digital platforms. And I think we'll see those technologies and practices being leveraged going forward. And I think we in many ways found for certain types of work it to be more productive. You know, I probably spend more hours working per day now than what I did before. And I think I'm more productive in those hours. But I feel good because, you know, hey, if I want to take a walk in the afternoon and breathe some fresh air, I can do that. I'm not going to feel like, hey, why is Derek leaving the office at 2 p.m? On the other hand, clearly some of the, I think where we really miss out is on those interactions where you really want dynamic conversation, collaboration, and some of the technologies, you know, they're not quite there yet. It's hard to replace having, you know, 6 or 7 or 20 people in a room, you know, talking and working together.
You know, it's fine. I agree with you. It seems like we've gotten really good at doing remote work and working, or everyone's 100% virtual. I mean, we can use Zoom or Teams or whatever the different systems are, or all in person. Where I'm struggling with, to be honest, is when it's mixed hybrid. I just came from a meeting where 4 people were remote in 4 different countries, and then 15 people in the room. And it's just tough to manage. You don't know who to talk to. They can never hear you quite well. They can't see you. So I'm struggling, and I'm curious how you've adapted this when it's a mix. Has that been a problem, or are you guys okay with that?
We're still kind of operating in the all remote working from home. So we haven't faced that too much yet. But I can definitely anticipate what those challenges would be, having run some events like that in the past. For example, it's one of the reasons that we do these customer advisory board meetings. We've never really run it in a hybrid model, just because it's such a poor experience for those people who are sort of you know, dialed in as opposed to those who are sitting in the room. Basically, the people in the room kind of forget about those who are dialed in. So that I would say is another one of those, you know, areas for improvement.
Have you seen those like robots that kind of move around with the monitor is the person's face and they can control? We've done some of those because we're at MIT. Of course, we have to try these things and they're just freaky. They're a little creepy. I don't know. It didn't seem to quite accomplish it because they don't have peripheral vision, for example. And so you still can't have that side conversation, which can be pretty important in a meeting.
Yes. And the body language and you know, all the communication that happens that isn't verbal.
That's true. That's true. I remember going to the first in-person meeting. It was at DAT headquarters in Denver in June. And it was my first in-person meeting for 14 months. And it was weird. It was like so productive. You forgot what it was to not just be looking at a box on a screen. So there's definitely a role for it.
Definitely.
So last topic, I want to talk more a little bit about Oracle's TMS, OTM. So I have to ask, what feature do you see clients taking advantage of that you didn't think they would? And on the flip side, if you're willing to share, what is the feature you thought would be the killer feature that really wasn't so much? Any thoughts?
Well, you know, I think the area that customers really, really appreciate and dig into a lot, but doesn't get touted a whole much in sales cycles or talked about by analysts or marketed even really, is in the whole area of managing the financial aspects of transportation. And by that, I mean, not just taking in like freight invoices and, you know, approving them for payment, but we've built up and customers love the features we have for doing things like detailed cost allocations. So my total shipment was, you know, $2,000. How do I allocate that down to all the orders and line items using all these different types of formulas? And oh, by the way, we need logic to assign all the GL codes to all these different cost components because that's how we're going to feed it into our financial systems to, again, understand things like cost to serve. And we also need these, you know, sales tax and VAT and all these what we'll call financial related, you know, functions. There's not a single customer that we have that doesn't use some set of all those financial features. Unheralded, but really, really important. So my brother can be vindicated that, you know, accountants truly do rule the world. We want to know. And then to answer your other question, you know, we've done some pretty sophisticated, what I'll call in the category of optimization stuff over the years that always hasn't been as widely utilized as we thought it might have.
Yeah.
We did this concept, what we called cooperative routes, which was this idea of forming continuous moves. It's kind of like a continuous, well, it is a continuous move, but it was one that you would design strategically and you know, look at probabilities of those routes actually occurring so that, again, when you go to execute, you would actually have freight moving, you know, in these lanes to connect them. And it was, you know, great idea, great technology. Worked well and worked well with one customer in particular, but it just never went mainstream.
Was that across customers who was looking for continuous moves, multi-company or within one company?
We had developed it in the context of within one large consumer goods company. So they have basically a very big network. But we thought, because we also have a lot of third-party logistics companies using our software where they are managing, you know, freight for multiple customers, that they would have been a natural kind of user of that kind of technology and would have benefited. Yeah. But it just never grabbed hold.
I remember the first paper I read about continuous moves was by Reynolds Metals, published in like 1989 in Interfaces. And they talked about it. Then I went to talk to the people who actually put it in. And they kind of said, yeah, you know, it really doesn't always work. But it was a great OR article, you know, right? Because the math is really fun. And finding the matches, we found this in the DAT FMIC customers. We can find matches. But the devil's in the details of timing, getting them to agree on levels of service, those kind of things. And they dwarf the problems that we solve with the math. I don't know if you've had the same experience.
Yeah, I would say it's similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's, again, it works extremely well in theory.
Right.
But in practice, there's all these sort of, I'll call it execution issues that just seem to prevent the benefit from being, you know, realized.
Right. I remember in the late 90s, early 2000s that everyone in the sales process wanted to see the maps. You needed maps. You needed maps on your TMS. But in practice, no one used a map. Because it takes too much time.
Because people who are dispatching know exactly where their distribution centers are and where their customers are.
They want, show me the green screen. I want the green screen.
No New Yorker needs a map of the subway system to get around.
Right. So where do you see OTM in 5 years? Where do you see it evolving to?
Well, I think, and then we've been doing, you know, our transportation product goes back to 1999. So we've been at it for a long time, and it continues to evolve because, again, the kind of the market evolves, the technology evolves. I think some of the things we'll see is some technologies which are very sort of nascent today will become more, you know, broadly adopted. Like we've started to do some work. And everyone wants to talk about artificial intelligence. We've got two use cases that we've already brought to market. One is around using digital assistants, which is your natural language, you know, chatbots. I think that has a lot of potential because it really makes it far easier for users, people using the software, to interact, to get the information they need, to take the actions. You know, one of the challenges in a TMS or any sort of supply chain system is just the learning curve. You know, all the menus, you know, where do I go to run that report?
Right.
But if I can talk to my software and say, hey, I need, you know, how many shipments did I deliver to Walmart late last week? And the report is served up to you, or where are all my orders that are in jeopardy of not shipping today? And that's served up to you. That really unleashes that kind of functionality. So that's one. There's work we're doing in using artificial intelligence to do better transit time predictions up front, so before you actually execute the shipment, so that you can plan better and recognize patterns. So I think we'll see those technologies being more broadly utilized. It's one example.
Okay. So it's very Star Trek, right? You talk to your computers.
Yes. There's the one where Scotty is, you know, talking to the mouse. You know, it's like, how quaint. You know. But we are, you know, the technology is evolving very quickly and getting to the point of being mainstream. And again, from a cost to serve perspective internally, the cost of for the chatbot or the digital assistant to process your transaction and to give you the response versus, let's say, calling a customer service center to say, hey, where's my load or where's my shipment? I mean, it's literally pennies on the dollar. So there's a very, very strong ROI for those technologies, which is another driver besides sort of the end user, you know, friendliness, you know, aspect to it.
That's great. All right. Well, thank you, Derek. I really appreciate your insights and your time with us this afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome, Chris. Really enjoyed it.
All right. So everyone, please stay tuned to hear the market update with Dr. Enam Yu.
Welcome to the Over-the-Road Truckload Market Update for November 18th, 2021. In today's market update, we will discuss the market changes in the last 2 weeks. Let's start with dry van. Active rates are up 1%. Spot rates are down 3%. Replacement rate is positive 17%. This means the new contract rates are about 17% above the rates being replaced. On the temp control side, active rates are up 1%. Spot rates up 1% and replacement rates positive 17%. In a modal, active rates are down 0.5%, spot rates flat and replacement rate is positive 8%. Finally, on the flatbed side, active rates are flat, spot rates down 1% and replacement rate is positive 6%.
All right, so Enam, this kind of the same as it ever was, right? It's looking very similar. What are your big takeaways this week?
I think it's now two updates in a row. We are seeing, especially for dry van, spot rates dropping. Again, this is a shipper's view, right? As the shippers see the spot rates. So it's two updates in a row. We are seeing spot rates dropping. If this continues, we would expect, you know, the active rates to start flattening out. But my only concern is we are still middle of November. You know, in that seasonal spot hike generally time period, right?
So
it could get derailed again just because of the seasonality issue. We still know the ports are at, you know, LA Long Beach ports are still at a record high level, vessels at anchor. So I think we are still not, you know, gone to a clear state where understanding that, okay, you know, things seems like things are slowing down. So I think that that is the case. However, if this spot rates continue to drop, then potentially the, you know, we should see the active rates flattening out sooner than later.
Got it. Got it. So replacement rates are a little higher than they were last time. They were, what, about a 13% positive, and now they jumped up about 4 points, 3 to 4 points for dry van and temp control. When do you think, that'll start coming back down in Q4? Do you think that'll wait till 2022?
I think realistically, maybe early 2022 might be where we see things really easing off again, because we will be out of the holiday season. But again, what's also important to understand from an active rates perspective is Q4 is also a time generally the annual bids are out.
Right.
Right. So those rates will start hitting the routing guides in February 2022. That's when we will see, you know, the larger portion of the contract rates being replaced, and we'll have a better idea what's happening at that point in time.
So we might see active rates going up a little bit at the beginning of Q1 2022, but we should see the replacement rate should start coming down. But the amount of active rates dwarfs the amount of new rates coming in, right? And so it moves relatively slowly. All right. All right. Any other last insights?
No, I think it seems like if you look at outside Walmarts in some places, you see containers outside. I think they have stocked the material. It's a good sign actually to see inventory out there, even though some of them are in the parking lots and so forth. But I think, you know, you had to give it to the shippers. I think they jumped through and at least made to where we are today. Yeah. It was a big achievement for the shippers.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's hustling to get this, get product on the shelves. All right. Well, that concludes this week's Truckload Market Update. Thanks, Enam.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Freight Find. The Freight Find podcast is hosted by Dr. Enam Ayub and myself, Chris Kaplis, and is produced and edited by DATIQ. For more information or to hear previous episodes, please visit our website at dat.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to The Freight Find wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to give us a review. As always, if you have any feedback or questions about what you've heard on The Freight Find or suggestions for what you'd like to hear in the future, send an email to me at chris.kaplis@dat.com. Finally, from all of us at The Freight Find, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new.